Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and
Lee Boy Alex.
Guys, keep calm and read your tickets.
We're using the Anna Karenina method here.
He's Alex.
Hello there.
I'm Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
Yay!
This is the Books Boys show. Get it?
Buy it.
Books. Woo! Alfred's with us as well. He's not showing up on camera, but he's feeling shy today. Got all the lads.
Yeah, I drank too much last night, it sounds like, and taking it easy.
Yeah, you know what Alfred's like. You can't rely on him. Can't trust him.
Nah.
PJ was always annoyed that he stole all the wages for the show. So.
Yeah, yeah, betting him on those like knife fights and
yeah, dog and that's fights, the thing. People think like, oh, these guys that are always begging people to take their Patreon, they must have no money. We make a fortune, just Alfred takes it all. You know, none of us get any. That's what's happening.
Yes, yes.
So, what's happening with us? We've read some books. We've got paper
yes.
Subjects here.
Together we have read books.
Yeah, some more than others.
As usual.
Yeah. And what else? You've gone back to the States. I've been in Spain. We've been on tour, as it were.
Yeah, doing so much, meeting so many people, reading so many books. Yeah,
I was in Madrid bookshops. That's all I can say. I was in Madrid for concerts. I went to Toledo, which is an amazing city that was originally the capital of the Visigoth Empire, and it was the city of three cultures: Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Until they expelled the Jews. Is what it is.
And I bought some Lorca plays to read in my free time eventually.
Is actually fantastic, because if you ever want to do those, I'll happily discuss those with you. I love Lorca. I also went to Segovia to see a Roman aqueduct and the Snow White Castle from the movie. And then I went to Ciudad Real, traveled around Madrid a lot more, had a great time. And now I'm back in lovely, rainy Belfast.
You get me confused there for a second saying Snow White, but I'm thinking the Cinderella castle. That's
Munich. It's not the famous Disney castle from like the logo and things, but it is the castle
from Munich.
The Snow White movie. Yeah. I knew it was Germany. I wasn't sure exactly where. That confused me when I went, because I was like, that's
a little
not
outside,
what I was
sounds
told.
Like.
Alfred has gone nowhere, but you know, we can't all travel.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got enough debts that need to be repaid here.
So, look, we read some books. I promised that I would start with a Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yes.
Here it is. The Pimpernels, they were scarlety. I have not let anyone down. By the Baroness Orczy. Now, this is a book set, actually, a lot of it's set in England, but it's set during and about the French Revolution, and bits of it are in France. Now, it's not what I thought it was going to be, because, and the clue was in the name of the author, the Baroness Orczy. So the French Revolution is where they're using the guillotine to kill eventually the monarch, but initially all the aristocrats, right?
She's very against it.
Yeah, in favor of a people's republic. So I'm thinking, well, the Scarlet Pimpernel, he must be a good guy. He must be a Democrat. No, because of course this is written by the aristocracy.
You see, I always remember, just in the movie version I saw, and this has been maybe 20 years, like, it's been a while, but maybe 15.
Hmm.
But I remember, like, him just going on, like, these types of, I don't want to say crusades, but it's, like, fun romps, and he's saving people. It's basically the Three Musketeers, but one guy is kind of my image of it.
Okay,
did you get that at all? Or
no, so
what
I
if the movie was
that is
different?
What I wanted to get, and I can imagine that in a movie they would make it feel like that. And this book does a little bit more of tell, don't show. So they tell us that this stuff happens, but we don't really see it. You know, It's like, oh, the Pimpernel, he's getting up to all sorts of hijinks. And we do see it once. In the very beginning, there's a funny moment where the guards are all out and they're like, we're not going to let this Pimpernel get anyone past us. And then this old lady comes through with a cart. And she's like, my son's got the plague. So all the guards are like, ah, get away, just go through quickly, go through quickly. And then, you know, they find out that old lady, yeah, it's that. That's it. He says he's not dead. And it turns out that, yeah, of course, the old lady was the Pimpernel in disguise. You're right. So that's why she said, you know, so that's the one time we actually see him doing the things that we think he's doing. And then that's kind of it. He's not really in the rest of the book. And then at the end, there's a bit of a reveal, like who he is. And I'm not going to spoil it. But I will say this. They basically have very few ideas as to who it might be. And it just happens to be basically the only person it could have been. Like, there's really no mystery to it, you know? So they give us this thing, like, they seek him here, they seek him there. Those Frenchies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That damned elusive Pimpernel. It's like, well, he wasn't very elusive. He was just the one guy that you thought it was. Like,
really? Okay. Yeah.
So it could have been fantastic. And honestly, look, it was still an enjoyable read. It's a good book, but it's just... Maybe it's because it's only 300 pages, and honestly, they're quite short pages in this big book. Like, I just thought it didn't, not a lot happened, you know? It was enjoyable, but it wasn't what I thought. I thought it was going to be what you thought, like the Three Musketeer vibe, you know, lots of high adventure.
That's what I kind of remember from the movie. It was like that. Maybe it's just one of those that's better adapted, kind of like Victor Hugo might be better adapted than Red.
Definitely. So. Yeah. I mean, with The Hunchback, at least, for 100%, the book was very boring.
maybe Middlemarch would be a good movie.
Yeah, you know, maybe they'll introduce any semblance of a plot, and then Middlemarch would be well improved.
Or Jane Austen books, isn't
it? all of Jane Austen. So yeah, like the only funny moment really is the bit with the old hag at the beginning. That was the best moment, the Monty Python moment. The main thing is that it shocked me. That's my main takeaway is, oh, we're supposed to be supporting the aristocracy. We're not supposed to be supporting the Republic, which, you know, I just never expected. Like, I should have, but I just didn't see it coming.
Yeah. Yeah. The author should give that away. Huh.
We have our main lady and her husband. So they're the Blakeleys, and her husband is Percy. And they tell us a lot of kind of, oh, he's a bit of a boring chap. And, you know, we can't believe this beautiful woman ended up with him. And that's the kind of vibe. And they're all going to these like high society events, you know. And the funny thing is they portray this relationship that they don't get on well. They used to be, you know, this Victorian stuff. Like they actually hate each other, but they're married anyway, kind of stuff. They were in love at one time. But they're not anymore, but they're just together and they don't really speak to each other and they don't communicate their feelings. And of course, secretly, they both do love each other, but they never know because they never talk about it. It's like every Victorian book, basically. And eventually, she asks her husband to help her. And the reason for that is she has a brother, Armand. And Armand is being held prisoner in France. And he had some note that lent suspicion to him. And there's a chap who's investigating. Chauvin, I think he's called, but this chap's investigating and he says, look, I'll tell you what it is. You're a society lady. You know everybody. Find the Pimpernel for me or I will basically kill your brother. So now she's like, right, I do like the Pimpernel. He's doing good work. All the ladies fancy him. He's the dashing hero, you know, even if they've never seen him. So the question is, do I save the life of a stranger or my brother? And she does have to mull that one over for a minute or two. And she chooses her brother. Good. And she says to her husband, look, I know you basically hate me, but I need you to go and help me get my brother. And he's like, cool. And he gives her like a bow, very formal, very cold, you know. But then it says, if she had cared to look a moment longer, she would have seen him go outside and react very emotionally. She would have noticed the tears in his eyes and she would have seen him kind of like, you know, acting wildly when he went outside because he is still in love with her and he will not do anything to help her. And then he helps her so well. And he's like, basically, there's a note, and it's like, oh, the Pimpernel's going to London tomorrow or whatever. And then their husband's like, I've got to go to London tomorrow to help you with the thing you asked. And she's like, is my husband the Pimpernel? And that's the only possible suspect for the entire novel.
And yes.
Yeah, based on just that. It does end nicely because we get a wee bit of action near the end, you know. But it's really not. There was no mystery element to it, which I thought there would be, you know.
Do you wish it were longer necessarily, or you wish more happened within those 300 pages?
I think I wish it were longer, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Because there wasn't. Yeah, there's a little bit. You could maybe trim 50 pages out of the 300, but you could also add about 300 more on, you know. And that's the thing. There wasn't a lot that was wasted.
And then you get a Dumas. So, yeah.
Yeah. Fair. There were some sort of amusing bits near the end. Like, the Pimpernel does resolve everything in a slightly amusing way. And there's a fantastic bit where the bad guy says to his four guards, "Guard this room, there's prisoners in it. Do not move until someone arrives." Is it? Yeah.
is a Monty Python
bit. It is. So he says, you know, don't leave here until the guy arrives.
Don't
leave.
Don't let him out. Even if you come and get him.
Then all the prisoners escape. And the guy comes back. He's like, "What the hell? You let all the prisoners escape?" I'm like, "Yeah, but you told us not to leave until the guy arrived. And he didn't arrive." He's like, "But you let all the prisoners escape in the meantime." He's like, "You don't pay me to think." Yep. Essentially, it's the Monty Python guards. Like, it literally
I love it. That's actually really good. Imagining that would have made it better, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So they just kind of let everyone escape, and it's quite funny. There's also a little bit of... There's one scene which I don't like, which is very anti-Semitic. There's another...
Really? At that time period? Never. Yeah. I just read Oliver Twist, so...
Yeah. There's also a fair few just random, like, slanderings of the French, you know, calling them frog eaters, and like, "Oh, you don't want these dirty foreigners coming over here," and all this kind of stuff, you know. And at one point, the guy's really slagging off French people, and they say, "Did you not marry a French girl?" And he's like, "Well, I got my pick of the best one, obviously, but we don't want the others, you know." So, English people, you know. But like, that's essentially, that's it. Like, I'm skimming through my notes here because I rushed on ahead. I think I've covered it all, really. There's one bit that I did miss where the woman herself does a little bit of... sleuthing. She wants to figure out what's on this note, and does it say something about the Pimpernel? So she knocks over a candelabra, spills candle wax all over the expensive carpet, and then while the guy tries to pick it up, glances at the note, you know, kind of makes a mess of everything. I thought it was very unskillfully done. Like, there must have been a better way to get a glance at the note without risking burning the house down, you know. But altogether, I would say it was a good book, but I thought it was going to be a great book. And I was a little bit disappointed, you know. And although there's a little bit of that romance interaction with the husband and wife, there's not enough of that to even save it or to turn it in that direction, you know. So it doesn't have enough of the high adventure, doesn't have enough of the romance, doesn't have enough of the mystery. It's almost like it's trying to do a lot of things, but very quickly.
All right, yeah. I wonder if that might be a good segue into my book.
Go ahead. I hear you read a book by a chap called a certain Charles Dickens. Is that...
So I read Oliver Twist, and it took me a while. I read basically the first quarter of it, and then took a long break, and then just this last month finished the last three quarters.
Mm.
I kind of had a similar feeling to you with The Scarlet Pimpernel, where, like, I'm just going to talk about the good things first. So, Oliver Twist, Dickens... He is a fantastic world builder. His imagery in it is amazing. I felt what all these cities looked like and the type of place that Oliver grew up. And you could feel how dirty it was throughout the entire book. And I kept thinking to myself, like, this is the society you want to live in, Dean? All right, sure.
But can you see why I like him as a writer? Like, he world builds and character builds beautifully.
He really does. He really does. He knows how to do that. He adds dialogue well. He does have some confusing moments because he'll call one character something at one point, and then later in that, like on the next page, he'll call him something else. I'm like, oh, did a new character come in? Who's this girl that they're talking about? Oh, it's Nancy. Like, okay. It would have been very helpful if he didn't really do that as much.
Okay. If you don't like that, never read Vanity Fair. Because people change, it's 1,000 pages long and everyone changes names constantly because they get promoted and, you know, the Miss So-and-so becomes something else. It's constantly changing throughout the whole book. It's a nightmare.
I wouldn't be able to.
What was also very surprising is that, like, so it really picked up for that last three quarters, I feel. The first quarter wasn't really grabbing me much, but I don't think it's really a spoiler to say that Oliver gets shot at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And I messaged you saying, like, this is when the book gets good. I'm glad Oliver's been shot.
Like, I like him. So you didn't like the beginning, because the beginning is... It's a lot slow. A lot of Dickens books begin in the same way. It's the slow orphan story, and that's in all of them.
But it also just goes from place to place to place. He starts off at the home, then the beetle comes to get him to take him to the workhouse. Then he gets sent to chimney sweeps, but that doesn't happen. Then he goes to the coffin builders, and then he goes to...
That's right. I forgot he works in the funeral place. That really could have been cut, to be honest.
It really should have. Yeah. And I'm like, that's the first 100 pages. Well, he also then gets taken by basically the vagabonds, Fagin, Sykes, and them, as he escapes from all that, and then escapes from them and is taken to, is basically saved by Mr. Brownlow and his whole household. And like, okay, I really liked that. But then found again doing a chore by Nancy, taken back with Sykes and Fagin.
Yeah.
Like, the first 100 pages. Like, it just feels like, are they going to be going back and forth and back and forth? But then they go on a job with Sykes and Oliver gets shot. But then he ends up with a family that he basically stays with for the rest of the book. Things still happen.
So the thing is, I imagine that it's supposed to give you this idea, like, no one really wants him. He is a bit of a vagabond. He's going around from pillar to post and, you know, he's not fitting in anywhere. And yeah, maybe you could cut out the Undertaker and a couple of other bits and pieces. But I always kind of got the feeling that it's just adding this idea that he's kind of getting kicked around from here to there. You know, it's adding to his orphan story. But did you get this feeling that even when he's safe, there's this constant tension that, like, they'll come for him. It won't work out.
Because after he joins, like, Miss Maylie, like, Rose and them, basically, I'm like, all right, when's it going to happen again? Right after Mr. Brownlow, like, they're going to be taken again. But then Oliver disappears for the last 100 pages. He's not really, he's in, like, maybe 10 of those last 100 pages. And this is a 400-page book. So, like, all right. We're just going to have everybody else do everything.
I forgot that.
It's still enjoyable.
It's the middle, really, that's the main bit, isn't it?
That middle half, the first quarter, last quarter, I don't really love, but yeah, the middle half, I'm like, all right, let's see where this is going. Like, that made me enjoy it a bit more. But even, like, on the list, I have the characters pulled up for Oliver Twist. Oliver's listed 7th.
Okay. What did you think of the band of thieves? I was in, as a child, I was in as one of Fagin's thieves in a stage production in Spain of this, of Oliver the Musical, yeah. I had very little to learn, but I love them. I love the Artful Dodger, of course, as well. He's the famous one.
He's barely in it, though. Like, he takes Oliver in and helps him out, and I liked him in that part all right, but then he just kind of disappears, and you see... every once in a while a scene with him and Master Bates. I love that name. then you have, they just kind of play poker or something. And then he gets arrested and sent to Australia. Like, okay.
They could have done more with him, to be honest. Also, Sykes, right. So, because I always went into this thinking the bad guy is Fagin, but really it's Sykes. Like, Sykes is horrible.
Because I always saw Sykes as the big boss of this group, right? Because Fagin always has to answer to him, and sure, you got like monks around and some others. I still don't entirely know who Toby Crackett's supposed to be necessarily. He's just kind of a guy.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, but Sykes is like, all right, he is like, when he pulls the gun on Oliver, is like, I will kill you if you say anything. Like, all right, I'm in.
Sykes is
he is very intimidating. And the way he goes out is pretty impressive. I like it. His dog.
It's like a big, fantastic set piece, kind of dramatic part, isn't it? Yeah.
But his dog has the worst way to go out. Like, I don't think it's necessarily a spoiler. Most people probably wouldn't care about this one plot point, but the dog jumps off a building and it smashes its brain against rocks and its brain falls out. It's like, what? This dog did nothing wrong.
And the situation with Nancy is pretty vomit-inducing as well.
So, I don't know, was she sleeping with Sykes?
It
always hinted at it, I feel.
I think she was kind of... I mean, she wants to get away, really. She's a prisoner, but I think she's essentially a sex slave, almost, in part. So I think she's been constantly raped, is the vibe that I got.
Yeah, they never outright say it, but I'm like, okay, there's something not right here.
Yeah, and I feel really bad for her.
Yeah, but... Yeah, she has a rough story. I like in the end, like a lot of the characters, Rose is so sweet and everyone getting along there. I guess everything just, he's related to everyone. Like, yay. All right.
There's a bit of a coin. Yeah, that's a very Victorian ending though. And it always has to work out fine in the end, you know?
Yeah. I feel a little bit bad for Fagin, though. I don't think that he should have been punished as much. Like, did he do anything that terribly wrong other than, like, having people steal? Like, he should go to prison for that.
Yeah, it's essentially just thievery, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not like he was the mastermind.
Yeah.
But I do actually, like, every once in a while, Dickens, in his books, will give his own opinions and, like, say some of his own ideas. Mm. It was only every once in a while, but I do have a favorite from this. Basically, the doctor says, like, the robbers, they came, like, so unexpected in the silence of the night, too. To which Dickens says, the doctor seems especially troubled by the fact of the robbery having been unexpected and attempted in the nighttime, as if it were the established custom of gentlemen in a housebreaking way to transact business at noon and to make an appointment by post a day or two previous.
So this is why I love Dickens, because that's how he writes. Like, the books are dripping with this kind of patronizing wit. It's fantastic.
I feel like, so his first chapter had a lot of that. It was really enjoyable. And then it was just sprinkled throughout here. I didn't see it for like 100 pages at some point.
I guess in some books it's there more than others. Right. It's also got the really long chapter titles as well one.
Each page has like a new title to it almost at the top, which is kind of fun. But yeah, you said before that Dumas had really short chapters. I think you might have meant Dickens. Because all of his chapters are like 6-7 pages.
I think it's both of them. Three Musketeers, they're like 6-page chapters as well.
No, they were longer. I thought they were like 20-30 pages at times.
No, I don't think
so. At least when I went through it, I feel like. But yeah, if you want like just quick chapters to get through, yeah, it's pretty good. I can't say like, I thought it was a good book, but not a great book, like you said earlier.
Okay.
Slightly disappointed that... Like, all right, I was expecting something a bit more maybe heartfelt or moving, exciting.
Mm.
But
so that that same basic framework is used in David Copperfield, in Little Dorrit, in Great Expectations. But those books are all a lot, well, Great Expectations are the same length. The other two are much longer. David Copperfield's double the length of this book. So maybe it's a similar problem that I had. Like, they could have done more with it if they'd given it a bit more time, you know?
Maybe. I also feel like maybe Dickens is reusing characters in a way. So this basically just feels like... So Oliver feels like the kid in Christmas Carol in a way.
Yeah, he does reuse
it's
a lot
like
of...
It's just like the pure boys. Like, you got
that's
all
of those. Yeah. And they all have this spectacular ending that it works out fine and everyone's in love and they all get married and it's happily ever after. Like, they have to... That's just what Victorians needed, I guess.
Yeah, I don't mind that. But I wouldn't mind, like, all right, this one thing went wrong. Well, okay, Nancy. Mm. So, fair enough. Nancy didn't get a good ending.
Would you read another Dickens? Like, not necessarily now, but in general. Like, how has this made you feel about trying him again in the future?
I'd be open to it. See, I'm generally glad that I read it. Mm. And especially since it's, like, it's one of those books that you gotta read at some point in your life. So,
yeah. And
I'd be open to some other.
You did send me one of the lovely images from the book, and we have confirmed that he did indeed ask for more.
Yes.
So that's the burning question on everyone's mind. He did ask for more.
Next year, it'll be Tale of Two Cities, right?
the worst one. You can maybe see it here. I use it to prop up my projector. It doesn't even make it onto the bookshelf.
It is there. I can attest to that because I laughed very hard when I saw that.
And
in Middlemarch underneath. No.
No, Middlemarch is too big. The projector will be on the ceiling. But it's a good book. Dickens' world building, his character building, his wit, that's what gets it for me, because I wasn't expecting it. I thought Victorian stuff would be boring, and I was so shocked at how funny Dickens could be, you know?
Yeah, he has some wit here and there, but yeah, if you want like fantastic world building and to be able to imagine everything that you're seeing, yeah, this is, he does very well with that.
He walked the streets of London at night because he couldn't sleep, you know, and he just noted what he was seeing and turned all those people into caricatures. So there is realism in what he's doing as well, you know.
He tells the story as if it's real, like as he experienced it.
Yeah.
Like he's a narrator telling the story of Little Oliver Twist.
Now, what did you think of the workhouse? Because it wasn't too long ago that one of the Tory MPs suggested bringing back workhouses.
Well, I definitely don't feel bad for the Beatle, but
I recently took an evening course on workhouses in Belfast, and they did not seem like pleasant places.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, probably lots of lost limbs.
Yeah. Well, there we go. We did a Dickens.
Now, on to yours.
Yeah, I will real quick just play this thing. And then...
The facts that will be presented are true.
Yes, PJ.
Hello there.
Now, PJ, what have we learned about Shakespeare?
He's in the heart of that!
Hello. Dark Place Robert and Playboy Alex.
Doing all right. Glad to be here again.
So I've given you those nicknames.
I'm not a fan of that one.
Well, that's where people will know you from. That's why
you're going to know me from that one, but let's carry on anyway.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Join us for Shakespeare Written, Spanish plays and poetry, rock star interviews, film reviews, Dark Place Dreamers, and more. Patreon.com/booksboys. And of course, we're now doing a lot of Greek plays on there as well.
We'll be doing Seven Against Thebes shortly, I believe.
Yes, our final Aeschylus. We maybe I'll look up how to pronounce his name before we do our last episode.
Maybe. If you remember.
I can't promise.
I'm definitely more excited to get onto Euripides and Sophocles. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I still am. So, and on that note, of course, patreon.com/booksboys. But you can also just go to booksboys.com. There's various links. There's merchandise. There's music and other bits and pieces. So go and be our friend. Follow us on Instagrams and so forth.
Get it.
Buy it.
Books. There
yes.
We go.
Hurrah. Now, the next book I read is Emile Zola.
So I know he is incredibly famous, but I know nothing about him.
That is more or less my position. Also, I had never read a book by Zola. I had heard of him. I'd read, you know, Balzac. I'd read Flaubert.
But Zola's even more famous than any of those.
Well, I didn't know he was more famous. I know he was a fan of the others, and obviously he came a little bit later. I'm going to say that I love this book, though. I did really like it. I have started a second Zola for next month, and I'm not liking it as much. So we'll see how I feel about that. But this one is Thérèse Raquin, and I really, really enjoyed it. It's sad, though. It's all this kind of realism and naturalism kind of stuff happening. There's no happy endings, there's no Dumas, there's no Dickens here. It's kind of sadness and horrible people doing horrible people things.
So
there
exact
is
exact opposite of mine.
Yeah, there's a song by the Wonder Villains called Zola, and I cannot load up a clip because I can't find the song. So what's happening here is Thérèse Raquin is our main character. So there's a lady called Madame Raquin, and she's living with her son, her little ill son. And her brother turns up to her house one day, and he's been in Africa, and apparently he's had sex with the daughter of some African tribal chief. And he turns up and says, oh, here is your niece. I have had this child. I don't know what to do with it. Off you go. And just leaves the kid and is never seen again. So Madame Rakan's like, well, I guess I've got this foreign kid to deal with now. So she puts him in with her child and raises them together. And because her son is always sickly, she decides that Therese must also be sickly and must share his medicine with him and share his sick bed with him and do everything together with him. And essentially raise the two children to think you will get married when you're older, even though you're cousins. In the end, they don't actually know anyone else, so it was really the only option but to marry, because they grow up in this house, every day is the same, and they only know two other people, like each other and the mum. Like, that's essentially their entire world in this sad little, French town that they start in. But they do eventually move to the city. So what happens is the mum had originally run a shop, I think, with her husband. He was dead. She eventually runs out of money, or she gives up or whatever, and off they move. They go to the city and they try to set up a new shop, and it's kind of dingy and crappy. But what actually happens is the son doesn't really like... It's not that he doesn't like the mum, but she really mollycoddles him and she keeps him as a child. And he doesn't want that. You know, he's called Camille, by the way. He wants a bit of freedom, a bit of independence, and he actually goes out and gets an office job. Doesn't have to be a good job. He just takes any crappy office job in a counting house and basically says, I'm going to be out all the time. I don't really want to come home to you people. But there is still this tacit understanding that they will get married. And they do get married. It's a very, it's a simple affair and all the rest of it. But Therese spends her days just working in this shop. And they specifically say it's the mum who brings in the customers, who chats with them. She just sits at the till, kind of stone-faced, what do you want? Okay, next. She really has no discernible personality in like the first 100 pages of this book. Except that we learn she's strong because she does wrestle with Camille at one point. And also that she just kind of feels empty, I guess. And she just concedes that her life will just consist of like sitting on this stool and never doing anything. The only thing they have for a diversion is there's a friend that the mum bumps into in the city, an old friend, and him and his son come around every Thursday for dinner. So they have a once a week little nice evening with a friend. The rest of the time, it's boring monotony. Camille bumps into a friend of his. He makes a nice friend and he brings him home and says, do you not remember little Therese? And she's all grown up now and, we're married. And the guy, he's the dashing playboy type. And Therese has never seen a real man before. Just this sickly boy. So she immediately falls in love with the friend. And the friend is an artist. And he says, I need to paint Camille's portrait. It will require me to be here very often. So he comes around all the time. And then he tries to kiss her. And I think it basically says for a second or two, she instinctively resisted and then was like, actually, no, I really want this. And it says they made love. It was brutal.
Oh.
So, exact quotes. He's called Laurent, by the way. So Camille and Laurent. Now, the act was silent and brutal, is the exact quote. Absolutely no...
Lots of wrestling.
Yeah, there is no attempt at feeling bad or anything like that. It is just, so we're going to have an affair then, right? And Laurent, sneaks in the windows and things and needs to sneak around all the time to come in and sleep with them. And... actually, it turns out that Camille had never made love to his wife. Because when Laurent mentions painting naked ladies, Camille's like, oh, it must be so strange to see a woman naked. I don't even know what I would do. And he's like, but your wife is right there. So it's clear that he's never thought of it. And it mentions, even when they were children, they used to wrestle and play and everything. But as they grew up and became teenagers, it never occurred to him, to kiss her or to feel anything when they touched, So he's not, maybe he's asexual, but I don't know if they knew what that was back then, you know, but he's just not interested in her. They get married because he was told to marry her. That's essentially what's happened. You know, the mum has told them both to marry. They didn't know anybody else. They were both like, cool, I guess we marry. This is going to seem like a spoiler, but it's actually quite critical because this is essentially two books. So that's the first half of the book. I think I've explained well enough. What happens in the midpoint is they think, what if we just kill Camille?
There you go. That just fixes all the problems.
So, yeah. Already Laurent's going off her, though, because she's just moaning about Camille all the time and moaning about her life and, you know, really, really attached to him. And he's like, I don't know, I love her that much. But no, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. We'll be together. It'll be great. It'll be great. So he picks up Camille and throws him out of a boat. But Camille bites him in the shoulder before he can get out. So he has this permanent scar now to remind him of the murder that he has committed. And then it kind of turns into Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. And they're like seeing the ghost of Camille everywhere. And it's all about the moral guilt that they feel for what they've done. And they wait a full year to be together, because if they married soon, it might cast suspicion on them. So they wait a full year. They don't speak to each other for a year. And then he comes around and they get married and they hate each other. And it's again this Victorian era of like actually hating the person you're with when you could be loving them. And they argue all the time. They physically beat each other. And then there's a horrible part where she gets pregnant, doesn't want to have a child with him, doesn't tell him she's pregnant, starts a fight so that he kicks her in the stomach and she has a miscarriage. It's rough. Like, it's very rough. Then the old mom ends up in a wheel, like in a chair. She can't move. She can't speak. And the whole time, Therese is constantly apologizing for what she's done to her while the mom is wishing her dead. So her existence is now stuck in a room with the girl who killed her son. And like everyone is miserable and they all hate each other. It's really, really rough. And it's all about their moral guilt.
So not very Dickens-like.
No. This is following in that kind of Flaubert style, that really just horrible people doing horrible things, you know?
Yeah.
And that's it. It's not a happy one.
Or, I don't know.
Yeah. And of course, they keep threatening to turn each other into the police all the time. And, you know, they never do. And they hate each other. They start cheating on each other. You know, the whole thing is just a mess. That's Zola, apparently. But it was a thrill.
It was gripping, yeah.
Yeah. Unlike the second one I've started, it was a very, very gripping read. So although it is sad, if you like that kind of thing, I would recommend it. So I'm going to play next a little message from the author Susan Ferber. We did chat with her in the past, and she's got a new book out, and she kindly sent it across to us. So here is her message.
Hello, this is Susan Ferber here, calling in. How are you? I just wanted to say that my new novel, We Were Very Merry, has now been published by Valley Press, and it is a sequel, a follow-on from my debut novel, The Essence of an Hour, which was published also by Valley Press in 2021. And it follows the same set of characters. It looks at the post-war period from the point of view of Lily Kerrigan, again in her first-person narration, as she goes from America to studying at Oxford to living in Paris with her husband, and as their marriage unravels and as she too falls apart. I hope you enjoy it, and you can find the book anywhere online in good bookstores, and the first book as well. Bye-bye! Thanks so much!
So there we go. Thank you so much for sending the book across. I'm going to start with a spoiler. They were not very merry.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't sound like a very happy ending. Well, the first book maybe didn't get the happy ending necessarily. And it doesn't continue on.
No, it's just so this one is set in the sort of mid-40s, you know, like that post-World War II kind of period. I'll show it to you if my camera hadn't turned itself off. There we go. Nope. Never mind. Nope. So I've got the book, and There it is.
There we go.
Good for the audio listeners.
Yes, but the video listener, they saw it for half a second. Hopefully
we were
you paused.
By Susan Ferber. How's your pause game? That's what the kids are doing on TikToks nowadays. So, in some ways, this is similar to the previous book. Now, obviously, it's a more modern styling, and it doesn't have quite the same level of sort of violent horribleness. But there's some similarities. You know, it is a story of a couple's relationship, of a marriage that really neither of them want to be in the end, and that isn't going well, and of the spite and the hurt that they cause each other. So there are some similar threads, even though the story itself is different.
Is it a similar feeling then to the Zola that you just read?
In a way, yes. Just without the, you know, there's no murder, you know, like without that sort of aspect. But there are some similarities. The very first note I made, though, was so one of the things that makes her fall in love with the guy. She meets this chap. She's in her friend Andrew's room, and Andrew introduces her to another friend. Lily is our main character. And they just mentioned this chap is reading Ryu's translation of the Odyssey. And it says it's the best translation. It is. They are right. So that was my first note. They are right about the correct translation of the Odyssey. So Lily had been in love with a chap called Teddy. He's dead. That didn't end well. But she holds him in her heart in such a way that she looks back on everything now with rose-tinted glasses through the nostalgia lens. And the new guy has to measure up to him. And he won't, because he's a perfect dead guy, right?
Yeah.
With no flaws anymore, you know. So that's one problem. It'll be interesting to see whose side you take at the end of this. I don't think I like Lily, but we'll get there, because in the beginning I like her. She has a friend Mallory, and they just like to do the typical things, you know. Mallory's a bit of an independent woman, but they like to go out drinking together and this kind of stuff. And her husband's always sort of saying, I know what it's like when you go out with her, you go on a total bender. Lily, whilst not an alcoholic, she does have that kind of problem. Her husband will often have to come pick her up. You know, she's in a right state, she's vomiting everywhere, this kind of stuff. It kind of seems like she's not growing out of that either. And she does exhibit some self-destructive traits. The least of all is the problem that she's not really over her dead ex, and probably never will be. But, you know, that's something that he tells her to go to therapy, you know, but that comes later. She's not interested in actually going to therapy. But their initial relationship is quite nice. They bond over books. He's got highbrow tastes, you know, which is fine. I empathize with that. She eventually writes a romance novel. And although she's the only one actually making money from her books, he's very much, you know, oh, but you're in a romance, you know, like I'm doing real stuff, you know. And it's like, oh, is anyone reading it? So it's that kind of thing. And then, you know, they even consider, should he do a translation of like the works of St. Augustine or something? But he doesn't really like the Catholic angle. But that's the type of stuff he's doing, you know, whereas she's writing a paperback that people might buy.
Yeah, fair enough.
But there is a little sense where it's kind of like he's almost looking down on her a little bit, you know? She essentially marries him because he's the first guy she's ever slept with. And she even considers, is this displaced Catholic guilt, you know? Because she was raised Catholic. And again, we're talking 80 years ago, so nowadays the world is moving a little bit more away from religion, but definitely not in that time period. So there's a lot of guilt there. And when they first hook up, it's a very student-y vibe, you know. They make love on the floor, and she only realizes when she wakes up. It's like, oh, this is filthy. You know, the place is really dirty, and we're drinking out of, like, old dirty, you know, cracked mugs or whatever. Like, it's not, you know, it's not a very nice lifestyle.
Instant regret.
Yeah.
That one night stand.
They get together anyway. they do end up having some good time together. And there's one summer where they go away to France together and they just sip champagne and make love the whole time and go for nice walks and have a great time. And she says, you know, if I was ever in love with him, it was that summer. But she's also not entirely certain, you know, like it's that if I was ever in love, it's not I spent many years passionately in love with him, you know?
Yeah.
And in a way, that's sad. Now, he's got a friend, Angela, and I think they might have had some interest in each other many years ago, like, you know, back in school or whatever, a long time ago. But now she's married to someone else. They're just friends. Because Lily's not happy in her relationship or really in her life and often thinks about cheating herself, she constantly projects this idea that you're having an affair with Angela to her husband. He denies it the whole time. And also, to be honest, there's no evidence in what we're told in the book that he ever is having an affair.
No, but it's constant jealousy. Like that, a lot of relationships have stuff like that. It's like, oh, your best friend is of the opposite sex. Like, yeah, I get how people can be uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I get it, but it's very toxic, you know.
Oh yeah, it's unhealthy. It's jealousy.
And, you know, he keeps saying to her, like, you act like I'm not a good husband, but, like, how many people would, like, put up with all the crazy behavior that you give and keep picking you up after these benders? And when she's drunk as well, she's very mean to him, says she never loved him, she never liked him, you know, she's really spiteful. And he's like, I know you don't mean it. He kind of comes across as the good guy in a lot of this. There's a couple times he says little sexist things. It was the 40s, you know. I don't think that he's no saint.
Yeah, it's still better than Victorian, where you own the woman, basically. But
yeah. And obviously, I feel sorry for her as well, because she isn't over her ex, and she obviously isn't enjoying her life. She clearly has mental health problems. It's hard to kind of pick a side. I just... Her behavior makes me not like her that much. You know, and I do empathize with the husband a little bit more. But then at times he's controlling, but only because she goes away for like a couple of months at a time to work on a book. And he's like, you really should come home. Please come home. I'm going to come out there and get you. And then he does. And he's like, please come home. It's a lot of that stuff where, like, depending on the intentions and how things were done, it could kind of go either way. You know?
Yeah. It just sounds like a bad match. Like, he's coming up, like, he's still looking down on her and all this too, it sounds like.
A little bit at times.
Yeah.
It does say here, though, that he reads Dickens, so he must be a good fellow.
Yeah, but it's only Tale of Two Cities.
Ah! That's how they get you.
Yeah, yeah.
There's times, though, when she even, you know, just goes out looking to, like, find someone to cheat with. And again, it's never explicitly clear if she does cheat, because one of the examples is, like, this guy kisses her and then he asks for oral sex, and then in the end she says no and leaves. You know, so it's not really clear if she does cheat, but I think she has the intention a lot of the time. She goes out, she's very self-destructive, is essentially what's happening, you know?
Yeah.
She has her friend Mallory that she really likes, but she has another friend, Lara, and that's her old friend. But she now looks down on Lara because she's kind of her, a bit more lower class. She's married someone. It's unclear whether they're really getting on that well. Mallory's thinking about marrying a rich guy. She knows that it's a starter marriage. She won't like him, but she's like, yeah, but then he might, you know, not be around for long. Like, so none of the relationships are good in this book, actually. And there's even another friend that they meet, another female friend, Cecilia or something, I can't quite remember her name, and they think she's the perfect girl, she's the great marriage, she's beautiful, and every time she speaks in confidence, she just complains about, like, her husband's junk not being up to scratch, basically. Oh. So like, none of the relationships are actually good ones, you know? Which is very sad. But Lily's isn't good, and that's the main focus. But she looks down on Lara, she goes to Lara's marriage, to her wedding, and then she's like, they try to set her up with the best man or whatever, you know? And she's like, oh, I understood the purpose here, the best man, was essentially to take my virginity and marry me. And he's like, yeah, so actually I already did that. I'm about to get married to this guy, and, you know, I've slept with him already and everything. And Lara feels a bit sidelined then, like, they were meant to be old friends, and she's not really being included, she's not even invited to the wedding, you know? They live in different countries, to be fair. But she ends up hating Lara in the end. And Lara doesn't do anything wrong. She's just part of an older life, I guess. And she hasn't moved on the way that she has with her new friend Mallory. And they're kind of trying to be more like society girls, going out drinking in the nice bars and things like that. Lara becomes one of those friends that you never do anything with her. You only meet occasionally to catch up about old times. You know, she's one of those friends now. And
fair enough.
She realizes that I don't actually need her, you know?
Yeah, it's fine to move on. I mean, there's no reason to hate her, but...
There's no reason to hate her, but that... Somehow she does. She actually really despises her in the end, and she's her maid of honor, and she really has no interest in even being there at the wedding. It's actually kind of sad.
Do you think that she has, like, feelings of, like, disdain, like, or even she envies her, like, oh, maybe she has a better life, or even, like, this reminds her of the past... And she doesn't want to remember the past necessarily, or it's just kind of spontaneous.
It could be, because she also knew Teddy. She was part of that old lifestyle of, like, her dead ex, you know. So maybe that's part of it. One important detail I've missed is that her dad is funding their entire lifestyle, because neither of the two of them initially are really making any money.
Yeah, they're
authors. So Lily's dad, and, you know, there's even times where he's like, oh, I've been paying for taxis that you're sick in, and she's like, yeah, out of my dad's money. So you're not paying for it. You know, you're physically handing over the money, but it's my money. Or it's my dad's money. You know, you haven't contributed this. And they just argue with each other all the time. Very interestingly, he's called John, by the way. I forgot to mention. But very interestingly, is her name. She's called Lily. Her old friends call her Lil. He calls her Lee. And introduces her to everyone as Lee. So she almost has this... two different personalities, you know. There's like the old life that she would have spent with the old people, with Lara and Teddy, and then there's Lee, you know. And that's kind of an interesting thing.
I wonder, yeah, that's like how the names change and all that. It's like you change when you change your life, like your names change a little bit.
Yeah, but I don't want to spoil how it ends, but it's not nice. It's not quite as bad as the last one, but it's not nice. They don't get on that well.
Yeah, you said no murder, so that's
there's no murder, right? That is a plus. I feel bad for John because he keeps saying, like, I know you love me, you know, and but you're being mean just because you're drunk and you're spiteful and whatever else.
I think he's just kind of telling himself that from what you've said.
It could be, you know, because it kind of becomes clear. Maybe he thought she loved him, I don't know, but... there's hints that they were never really perfect for each other all along, you know?
No.
The sexism is there, of course. They go to a bar, and the barman literally says, don't you think you ladies better get back home? Your husband's dinners need seeing too, you know?
Oh, fun. I was watching a show recently in the 1920s. Like, a woman goes to the bar, and the bartender's like, yeah, no single women at the bar, or no women without men at the bar.
Wow. Yeah. I have not been in a bar like that, but I've been told that bars like that still exist around here. It's kind of like we don't really like women in the bar. If they do come in, they should kind of stay at the back and not get in the way. Kind of, it was insanely shocking, but I've been told that such a place exists not too far.
It sounds like one of those bars that we generally, it's on the opposite side of the wall that we stay on.
Yeah. But apparently
I'm talking about the Peace Wall in Northern Ireland.
Anyway, such places do exist. But the summary is, she's obsessed with her ex. She projects all her fears and anxieties and paranoias onto John because of his relationship with Angela that doesn't really exist. And one of my favorite moments, she sits at her vanity table, making herself up, and just casually crushes her husband whilst, you know, doing her makeup, brushing her hair, whatever. Emotionlessly and casually just says, look, I always wanted to love you, but I never did. I never have. You were just the first person I met. That's really all it was. And he just cries and cries. And she's like, yeah, there we go. I'm brushing my hair. Like, just so cold. It's really hard to read that scene. But...
Yeah. I don't think that your opinion on her being the bad one is... far off.
No. But again, I can see there's a little bit on both sides. You know, no one's perfect, you know.
Yeah. I also see it like she's just kind of done with it. It's like, I can't deal with this anymore. I'm just gonna be cruel to you because you've done nothing for me.
Yeah, I don't know. He calls her a spider. But, you know, he also, she's having mental health issues and things as well, you know? But then part of it is he's telling her, you need to get help. Then she treats it like he's gaslighting her, you know? Like, I don't need help. You're trying to make it seem like I do. And I'm like, I feel like you do, though. I think he might be right this time, you know?
Couples therapy?
Yeah. Their relationship is or a divorce. Mess, but we do see the times when they were very merry, like that summer they spent together, some nice times, you know? And it's a shame that it just didn't work. But look, that's We Were Very Merry by Susan Ferber. Under 300 pages, quick enough read. I liked it a lot. Yeah, I liked it a lot. So far, I've been pretty happy with all the books that I've covered this month.
Good to hear.
I say so far as though the next one is going to be horrendous or something, but it's not. No, I actually liked all the books that I covered this month. But so far, and then this pile of crap, no.
Yeah, but you also have one day left, or well, no. No, it's already, 11:23?
I've got half an hour left to
find a bad book.
The next book I read, so you may remember that we had recently, I had recommended a book by Carlos Ruiz Zafón to a friend of mine, who you also know, Lupita. And yes. She phoned into the show when she read the first book, I believe that was with PJ still here, potentially. She read the first book in the series, and she gave us
this is the one with, like, three or four books?
Yeah. You must have seen me passing her the book, yes. Big books. Yeah.
Yes.
So she told us that she liked the first book, and I just thought I would quickly mention that she went on to read all four and the little bonus fifth one, and said it's now her favorite book series ever. So she's thankful for that. So it put me in the mood to look back into Zafón myself. He also wrote four smaller books that were kind of not part of the overall series, and they were also a bit more young adult-y, right? They were less intense, or at least that's what I thought. And I think the first three of them might be, but the fourth one is definitely not. This is Marina by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. It was gifted to me in Gran Canaria last month by PJ, and he's written a nice little note inside. But it's pretty short compared to the others, you know, the big ones. This is, we're talking 230 pages, something like that, okay? So it's nowhere near the length of the
800-page
Yeah, you saw that big one. Yeah. This one's much, much shorter. And I will say that although the main characters are young people, you know, I didn't see this as particularly a young adult novel. It still deals with similar themes to his adult books, to be honest. It wasn't like a juvenile kind of affair, you know? But the main guy is in school, but I think he's in a kind of religious school, and I think he's actually learning to potentially be a priest or some kind of religious figure, actually. But he keeps asking to get out of the school to go and see this girl, Marina. But I'm skipping ahead a little. Essentially, he sees this big old house and he's like, I'm going to go in there. So he kind of goes into the house and he meets Marina and her dad, German. And he finds this old pocket watch, you know, and he gives it back and he says, he steals it initially, but then he comes back and gives it back and says, oh my God, I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me. The house seemed weird and mysterious and, you know, I couldn't find anyone around. I took the watch. I'm so sorry. I give it back. And they're like, yeah, you know, why don't you come to dinner? So they just befriend him. German gets all dressed up fancy. But then they have like one course. And he realizes they don't actually have any money. They live in this big old house, but they don't have any money anymore, you know? And Zafón's Barcelona is a bit like Dickens' London. It's a disastrous, kind of sad, falling apart per place. And essentially, we learn that German is ill, okay? And there's some hospital appointments which we believe are for German. This is another book that's kind of split in two. So in the first half, we get a bit more action and investigative type stuff. So basically, they go around, they're hunting around the place, having a bit of fun, you know, and they find a greenhouse, and they see a photo album in the greenhouse belonging to a Mikhail Kovanik. And they decide to try to give this photo album back to the chap. They go to the only address they can find for him, And there's a guy called Benjamin Sentis living there. And he says, no, Kolvenik's dead. But I live here now.
I'll take it.
Well, essentially what happens next is it turns out Sentis worked for the company that Kolvik worked on and actually forced him out of his own company. So there's a bit of stuff going on there. And then Sentis turns up dead. There's a mysterious lady in black that they keep seeing that gives them like the address to go to and things like this. And things get a bit mysterious there. And that turns out to be Eva, the widow of Kolvenik. And there's a chap, Luis, who was an old driver, kind of servant of theirs. Eva's horribly disfigured and wears a veil. That's why she's the kind of woman in black vibe. She's trying to hide her disfigurement. Turns out, and there's little periods of this where they just give us people's backstory for like 30 pages. So Eva's backstory is her orphan child taken in by these like Slavic people and sent to the circus and then not allowed to escape. But Mikhail wants to marry her. She manages to escape. So the kind of foster dad throws acid in her face and disfigures her.
Of course, as you do. Yeah.
Mikhail himself, his backstory is that there was a, you know, they grew up in these kind of tunnels under the city. They were kind of homeless or whatever. He escapes and meets a guy who also had a son called Mikhail who is dead. And he's like, you're the new Mikhail. Come in. You replaced my dead son. So he hangs out with him and teaches him a lot about technology and science. And he learns a lot from him. And then he thinks, I'm going to fix these things. And, you know, he tries to fix his wife's disfigured face. And then he tries to do a lot of other similar work on himself when he gets ill. And his body becomes a mess of tubes and cables and things. It's almost body horror. It's almost a Videodrome going on here.
Sounds like Frankenstein type of...
Well, I'm glad you say that, because then they go to meet a Dr. Maria Shelley. Sorry, a Dr. Shelley and his daughter Maria. But yes, and she's involved, and lots of other stuff is happening. So the Shelley is very on the nose there.
I love it. I love it. And he's I wonder what he read before then.
Yeah. He's in the photo, one of the photos in the photo album, and he keeps it, and it's evidence that he was involved in this stuff. Then these dolls with like real hair on them. It essentially turns out that this guy has been taking bodies from morgues and doing Frankenstein work to try to like figure out how to cure people and how to rebuild people and this kind of stuff.
All right.
And one of them ends up attacking our main character in his own home. But meanwhile, he's going back to these lovely times in Marina's house where they're listening to like music and all the paintings were painted by Germain. The music on the, it's like, who is this great opera singer? That's my dad, mum. You know, it's a very artsy family. And Germain hasn't painted since the mother died. But he paints a picture of his girl, or draws a picture at least, and gives it to Oscar. And he says, that's so you can remember my daughter.
Hmm.
So all this action stuff is building up. They even get like a retired cop involved. There's a lot of stuff going on there. It's very good. And then that just all stops. And now we find out it's not Germain who's sick. It's Marina who's dying. The little girl. So the second half of the book becomes a kind of forlorn romance. And Oscar wants to be an architect and he wants to build a cathedral for the girl he loves. And it becomes this kind of sad love story in the end about a dying love. It's again, it's interesting. Like this theme today is like a lot of books that are doing 300 pages long, but they're trying to do like two different books in one, you know, like a lot of different stuff going on. It was an interesting juxtaposition. Like, it's an interesting swerve to take.
I get it in a way. It reminds me a little bit of like Thomas Harris, what he does with Hannibal Lecter. Like, he makes him like kind of a upper class almost. Like, he's into opera and this learning like all about art and all this stuff, but he's also a murderer.
I really like those types of characters, you know.
Yeah, I'm getting like, yeah, Mary Shelley vibes, Thomas Harris vibes, but I'm also getting like Shirley Jackson vibes. She's the one who did The Haunting of Hill House.
Right.
The movie The Haunting.
Yes.
And it feels like that a little bit, which I might have to add that to a list for Books Boys at some point.
It could be an interesting one.
Yeah. Have you ever done a Books Boys where you both read the same book?
Mm, Sometimes PJ would have known the books I'd read because he'd previously read them, but I think the only time we both read a book at the same time
was an
I
author.
Think it was one of the authors, and he didn't actually finish the book in the end, but we both read bits of it. Yeah.
Something to think about.
Yeah. But no, it's a very good book. Zafón builds this dystopian Barcelona in a beautiful way. There's a little bit less world building in this one than the others, just because it is a shorter book and it is kind of a young adult thing. It's a little bit sort of messy because you've got all this action stuff happening, and then it seems like a lot of different stuff is kind of coming out of nowhere, and then it's just over. And the pacing was weird for me then, because I'm like, there's a lot of pages left, but everything's kind of ramping up suddenly. And then it's like, cool, and now an unrelated story, you know? But it's still very nice. It evokes emotion, but, you know, it gets you with all the action stuff, and then we just go to, like, a nice emotion-invoking part, and the doctor's there, and he's very kind and everything. Having a character literally called Shelley, I think, is my favorite part of the book, to be honest. that's very well done.
So what age is this? Like, when did he write? Like, 80s?
No, so Zafón wrote, like, this book, I think, is 10 years ago. I think it's 2013.
Oh, wow, it's very
recent. These are recent books, and he only died a couple of years ago. So these are very recent books. I think he only started writing in the 90s, and most of his books are noughties, you know.
Did not know.
Yeah, so it's modern works. He's considered very, very, you know, one of the most famous authors from Spain now. Very, very successful. This book, it's just a little bit shorter, so you don't get quite as much development as some of the others. But honestly, I really, really enjoyed it. And I was surprised, because I thought, oh, this is going to be the kind of young adult stuff. It's going to be a bit simpler or whatever. Still had a very good story. I read it in Spanish. It still was in, like, proper. It wasn't, like, in kind of written for kids or something, you know? Like, it still reads like a good novel. I really enjoyed it. And thank you very much, PJ, for gifting it to me. It's absolutely wonderful. With much love, Books Boys and Bufanda Boys, PJ. So that was that one. I don't know, there's still one or two Zafons I haven't read, but they are a little bit more childish, I think. They're part of the... He wrote three young adult books, and then this one came later, and I think it's around the time he was writing his real adult books, so it kind of fits in more with those, whereas I think the other three are a bit more childish. I read one of them, and I didn't love it as much. Anyway, there we go.
Well, there we go.
I read one last book by Chris Bishop. It is called The Prodigal Son. This is set in Wessex in the year 893.
Yeah, so this would have been around, like, Viking...
The Vikings are attacking.
And... Yeah, there we go. Okay.
The Vikings are attacking. And we have King Alfred, not our Alfred.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole show on this, isn't there?
Is there?
More or less. Well, at least on the time period. I need to look... what it is, but yes, please continue.
So it should be accurate, because Alfred was a real king of England at that time. We have a stretched lineage from him to the modern day that we can kind of trace everything. But essentially, the Vikings are attacking, and there is a chap, Edward, who his uncle Edmund is trying to kill him. Now, that happens. There's a one page introduction which basically says, "Here's what happened in the previous book," because this is book five.
Wow.
Previous book, Edmund tries to kill his nephew, over inheritance type stuff, you know. Edward was raised as a stable boy, but then realized, actually, I'm able to inherit all this stuff while my uncle's off on a you know, slave in a Viking ship. But Edmund escapes and comes back and tries to kill. And that's kind of where this book picks up. But we get, you know, a ragtag bunch of merry men at one point that Edmund joined up with. Edward himself, he has a love story, and he has a character growth story as he kind of matures and you know, becomes a leader and this kind of stuff. Very, very good stuff, though. I really, really enjoyed it. And I think it was well written. There's a couple of, you know, funnier bits in it as well at times. Some of the characters are interesting. There's a fat priest that gets robbed and stripped naked, and that's very, very, not, it's very funny. He's a father, Cuthbert, I think he's called. That's like one of the main kind of comical parts. There's prostitutes in it. There's a lot of sort of sex bits as well. Again, it's just under 300 pages. So I thought I wasn't going to get much read this month because of my trip. But in the end, I read just shorter books. And then it was It was completely fine, and I got them all in. But very good one.
Oh.
Hold on 2 seconds there. Now, Alex, we're getting a phone call. I will see you on the line and be back with you in a few moments. Hello, you're through to Books Boys. You've got Dean on the line. Who's calling?
Chris Bishop, author of The Prodigal Son.
First of all, what a coincidence. We were just talking about The Prodigal Son. I read it there last week. I read it on my holidays in Madrid, actually. I sat in a lovely park with little rowboats around, and I read the book, and I absolutely loved it.
Good.
Now, this is the fifth in the series, The Shadow of the Raven. This is the final one as well, am I right?
That's correct, it is.
Yeah. Okay.
I have said that before. I've said that about three, but, you know. But no, it is the final one.
Now, I haven't read the previous books. Very helpfully, you do start with a little couple of page kind of summary of book four, so I was able to get up to speed. So you mentioned there that you were thinking about stopping after book three. Are books four and five kind of self-contained, or would it be helpful to read the whole thing?
I think all the books are written to be read as standalone stories, so you don't need to have read anything. Well, I hope you found that to be the case with book five. But the series lends itself into two parts. Books one to three concern the main character there. It's a young boy who's of noble birth and put into the church, as often the case with the youngest son.
Sure.
But he has to set his religion aside and become a warrior because he gets embroiled in the Battle of Edington and Alfred's problems with the Vikings. So it's quite a long story. Books two and three sort of follow on his adventures from there.
Right.
Book four introduces his illegitimate son, whose mother was a prostitute. And although Alfred knows the family well and is pretty sure this is genuinely Matthew's son, he can't be absolutely sure. So he takes him in as a stable boy. And then at a certain point, he decides, well, got to see how he gets on. And he sends him to Wareham on the pretext of training Fleet, which is a magnificent black stallion thought to be unrideable. From there, Edward excels and gradually develops skills as a warrior and culminates in the Prodigal Son.
Okay, so that gets us up to speed. And you're right, I mean, all that I really needed was that little introduction, that little bit, the story so far. And I said, okay, I know what's happened in book four, and now I can read book five, you know, as a standalone. So that was great. You mentioned Alfred. So Lord Alfred, he's the king, essentially. So is he supposed to be literally Alfred the Great, the actual historical king of the Anglo-Saxons? Because the time period matches up as well.
Oh, yes. No, he is. He is.
Yeah.
At least he's supposed to be. Very difficult because we don't have very much historical evidence. Most of the contemporary accounts are written by, well, the victor, not the vanquished. Alfred was both in different parts. But certainly what we know of Alfred has come from Alfred or from his advisors putting things down in writing. So there are big gaps to fill in.
Yeah.
And I've done that hopefully as accurately as I can.
No, that's fair. So we're in 893 in Wessex, and I looked it up and said, yep, that is the right time period for Alfred the Great. And it's quite interesting because you can kind of start there and go almost until really today with this constant lineage of the English throne. So it's really, really interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Fantastic to have that level of documentation. So our main chap is Edward then. He's the illegitimate son. But at this point, by the time we're in book five, it's more or less accepted that he's the son and he's the main character now for us.
Yes.
And he has his uncle, Edmund, who spent a long period of time, was it 10 years, 15 years, as a Viking slave?
Yes, he was taken right at the beginning of book one and taken into slavery, as was his sister, Edwina. They all have this... Saxons tended to have a name that begins with the first letter of their father. So, you never get Edward Edmund, which gets a bit confusing. So I have to be very careful not to confuse the reader. But yes, Edmund is starts out as a good guy. But clearly after 15 odd years of slavery, he's not too enamoured with life. And he sees Edward as perhaps stepping in and taking the family fortune, which he thinks he has a right to, hence the conflict there.
Yeah. So he's come back and he's out to kind of get what's his, essentially. Meanwhile, Edward, yeah, he's trained Fleet. At this point, he's riding the horse magnificently, very impressive. He's made a lot of friends in Wareham. He seems to be getting on really well. And he's begun courting, is it Odelia, this nice lady? Yeah.
Yes.
She's a bit of a coquette with him at times, you know. She's kind of not wanting to go too far, not wanting to say, yes, I will accept your proposal, but, you know, you got to go jump through a bunch of hoops and then we'll see, you know, and not kind of,
yes,
not wanting to make any promises, you know.
No. She puts him through a hard time, doesn't she, really? Yeah.
She does a little bit, yeah, she does. But at the same time, she's kind with him, and even when he visits the prostitute, she just rules a line under it, you know, which is fair enough. Because I suppose Edward is a very naive chap, really. I mean, he grew up, as a stable boy, so he doesn't have that much life experience. And they say, well, he doesn't know anything about, you know, what he's supposed to do with his wife when he gets one. So we better send him to this prostitute just to learn a little bit about what goes on, you know. It's quite funny.
Yeah, you've got the added problem that when Edward first meets her, he's a stable boy and she's the daughter of the governor of Wareham.
So she's way above him. Yeah.
Gradually, he overtakes her. Suddenly, he's likely to become a lord in due course. And she's just the daughter of the governor, you know. So their roles almost reverse.
Yeah. And that's very, very interesting to see their development, because they have a good connection with each other. And I think that they're both, whether she admits it always openly or not, they're both happy that they're kind of in love and they're going to end up together. Even though their positions reverse, they don't really let it affect them, which is nice to see, you know. But you're right, by in the beginning, it is kind of, he's beneath her. And by the end, it's like, well, he's actually going to probably become the governor here and then also become a lord somewhere else, you know, in another, in some more lands and grow. And she's just going to be stuck here. Which is good. I don't want to give too many spoilers, but I do want to ask you a question. I'll try to phrase it sort of generally. Do you believe that Edmund does repent or not? Is it just a sham?
I think it's a sham, but I think there may be some guilt going on there. I think suddenly he has to sort of confront reality and destiny. And I think at that point he might begin to think, maybe I got this wrong, you know. I think I want to go further than that because, as you say, it's part of the tension there is how does he really feel? He's a strange character, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
I mean, again, he's had quite a rough time. I think, as Ed points out at one stage, you know, he started out part of a very noble family. You know, his father was an elderman. He was taken as a slave. He's been through hell.
Yeah.
He manages to escape by skin of his teeth, really, and suddenly, you know, he finds that someone else has stepped in, someone he wouldn't have known anything about, because he wouldn't have known Matthew in books 1, 2, and 3. So he might have known of him, but he wouldn't know much more than that.
So I think really, because initially you see him as okay, he's the villain, right? You know, but then there are more complexities, and once you get the backstory, you kind of think, I can see where he's coming from, you know. He was taken away. He's just escaped, and now he's thinking, you know, I've got to come back and take what I assumed was going to be mine. Like, it's totally understandable. But of course, Edward is just like, well, we'll have a chat about it. We'll work it out. We'll share it all. But Edward's very naive, you know. And Edmund's trying to kill him. You know, so
yes. That's pretty good. Yeah, yeah. It's trying to kill him. Yeah.
For Edward, it's very nice. So that's where we start. You know, in the story so far, that first page, we kind of start with Edmund had tried to get an assassin to kill Edward, thinks that it worked, but it didn't, and then killed the assassin. So he certainly has a taste for it, you know.
Yes, he's ruthless, isn't he, really?
He is. And then he joins, of course, Fireman and his band of, well, I like to think of them as the band of merry men, but this kind of robber band out in the woods.
Yeah.
We've got a Viking, we've got a giant, we've got a, you know, guys with injuries and everything, and Winifred, who's of course turns out to be the prostitute's mother, but she's just kind of living with them in the woods. They're an interesting ragtag kind of bunch of chaps.
Did you like them as characters?
I did, yeah, I did, and I especially, again, I'm not going to spoil it, but I like that one of them has a nice kind of story towards the end. So that was nice, but they're good characters.
Good.
What was the Was that all, you know, the way it goes, it doesn't really work out well for them. I suppose for most of them, that was inevitable, really. They were outcasts, weren't they?
I think that's the word I would use. It was an inevitable ending for them.
Yeah.
But perhaps the two who got away were lucky.
Yeah.
Cedric and I suppose that not so much the boy, because, you know, well, I better not say, but his life looks pretty rough from where he's standing. He hasn't been executed, but it's a pretty rough road ahead of him.
Yeah, I think Cedric's the only one that goes well for.
Yes.
But that was nice, because, you know, in the beginning I just saw them as a homogenous group, but then you do get to see them individually a little bit more, and then I'm kind of rooting for Cedric at the end, so it's nice to have one of them and say, okay, you know, because it's similar to Edmund, really, none of them wanted to necessarily be there. It's just the route that their life had put them on, you know.
Victims of circumstance, really, weren't they? Yeah. I mean, you have to feel a certain amount of sympathy for the way their lives turned out, because they didn't have a lot of choices, you know.
No.
Simple as that.
And it was certainly a tough life. But one of my favourite characters, I think, is actually Father Cuthbert, you know, because he's introduced just this, and even Edmund says, you know, you priests are out swindling people and whatever else, and, you know, he's this fat priest coming through with his guard and a little cart. So he robs him, makes him strip naked, you know, kind of humiliates him, sends him on his way to the village. But the whole time, Cuthbert is a bit of a coward as well. He makes no attempt to stand up for himself. And even later, when they think the Vikings are going to come, he's like, oh, it's about time I got going back to my own parish then, you know?
Yes.
And they say, oh, off you go. We can't lend you any guards, but off you go. It's like, oh, I might stay put for a little while then, you know, if there's no guards. Like,
yeah, a coward is right, isn't it, really? I mean, yeah, he dodged everything, didn't he? Yeah.
He's a funny coward, you know?
Yeah.
What becomes of him? I don't think we really go into any detail with him. He just goes back to his parish and he's happy.
He goes
enough,
back to his parish. He returns to Winchester, and which was then the capital of certainly of Wessex and probably of England, really. But yes, he just toddles off to his parish from there.
Off he goes. Well, this is the fifth book, and you've said it's not the first time, you've said it's the last one, but on the assumption that it is the last one, what's next? Are you going to write something different? Have you got any ideas?
I've got lots of ideas. I suppose the one which is if I finish writing it, it would be almost a prequel to book one. It would be the events leading up to the Battle of Edington, which was a very significant battle. I mean, it was probably one of the most important ever fought on British soil, because of Alfred being defeated at Edington. That's it. We'd have had a Danish ruler. We got a Danish ruler in the end. In fact, our own royal family are directly descended from the Normans, which basically is Norsemen. They were Danes. I might try something completely different. I don't know. I need a bit of a rest. Five books in 5 years is a lot to have taken on. So we'll see. But I'd like to carry on, yes. And I've got lots of ideas in my head about what could be done.
So is this something you always wanted to do? You know, did you write before this series, or did you just focus on your other career first and then get to this?
It was my life's ambition to write a book.
Right.
One day I thought to myself, well, I used to publish short stories here and there, and I wrote a series for a windsurfing magazine. One of my passions was to windsurf. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a regular column for Windsurfing magazine, and I won a competition in the Times for a rather futuristic story. But it was always to write a book. And then one day I thought, well, retirement's looming, time getting on a bit. Let's do it. I was only going to write one book, but here we are.
You've ended up with five. But the first one's going to be the hardest, because you don't know if you have it in you to do a full novel. And then once you know you can do it, then it's like, oh, cool, so do another couple, you know?
Yes. It took a long time to write, but funnily enough, if you look at my website, there's an interesting story there that I wasn't writing the novel at that point. I was going to write a short story for a competition about a team of archaeologists who discover the grave of a boy in a rather remote and lonely place. Mm. So the story is really a sort of time team thing where the archaeologists weren't agreed on what happened and why he was there. So I needed to create a backstory for that character. Once I did, it just sort of came out. It was almost as though he was sort of guiding my pen as to what happened next. And looked up, actually, I've written an awful year, or best part. But I've had a lifelong interest in Anglo-Saxon history, so I have plenty of information for that.
I was going to ask you that. That was an area, it wasn't an arbitrary choice. That was something you'd studied before you had an interest in.
It's fascinating. I read Hereward the Wake at school, and that got me started on it, and I've always enjoyed it since. So it still needs lots of research. I mean, the books are heavily researched. I really did go into a lot of detail. Some of it, guesswork, you know.
Yeah, you've got to fill in some gaps.
Yeah, yeah. Particularly the Vikings, because they didn't write anything down. And what we've got about the Vikings is really archaeological evidence. Mm. So, you know, you can't say, oh, well, look, he said this or he said that. We don't know. We don't know what they were. And there's no such thing as Vikings as such. Vikings was a lifestyle choice. There's no people who were Vikings. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There were people who used to Viking for a living. That's what it was, a verb. They went out and pillaged and stole and so forth.
It was more an occupation than a cultural group of people.
A lifestyle choice, I think, is the current sort of phrase.
Fair. So I'll let you go. Do you want to quickly give us a plug for your website or where people can go and buy the book?
Yes. It's on Amazon. That's the best place, I think. My website is chrisbishopauthor.com, and you'll find quite a lot of other blogs about the Anglo-Saxon period. All five books are there. There's links through to purchase them via Amazon.
There's also another
series I've been working on about fly fishing, which is another passion of mine, and there's a few examples of that there. Don't know where they're going, but they're up there for the...
Fair enough. I'll put a link to the website in the show notes anyway. Last question that we ask everyone before we let you go. If there's any existing book that you wish you'd been the person to write, what would it be?
That's a hard one. I suppose, given how much it influenced me, Hereward the Wake. I thought it was a fabulous story, but it's aimed at, well, I suppose it's aimed at younger people, but I read it and was just enthralled by it. A lot of books at that time in my life, The Lost World, Conan Doyle, King Solomon's Mines, those sort of classics, those exciting classics, are what I like to read. Contemporary books, I don't do a lot of reading now because I do too much writing.
Too much writing,
yeah. But I think they would be the sort of genres that I'd be looking at.
Okay, fair. Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for calling in, and I love the book. So if you do release anything else, maybe take a year off, but when you get to it, I'll certainly check it out.
Lovely. Thanks.
Take care. Bye. Well, wonderful coincidence there. Chris Bishop calling in just as we were talking about his book, The Prodigal Son. I do regret starting on book five in a way, but at least it is kind of a standalone.
It sounds like you really can do that. So that gave me enough time to look up the show called The Last Kingdom. And it is about like Alfred the Great. And it's a very interesting time period. So I imagine the book was also very similar. Like, it's historical. And did you happen to ask how much research he did?
Yeah, so he did a lot of research, you know, for these. It's one of those interesting things where you're only writing less than 300 pages, and you've got to put a lot of fictional elements into it with the characters and their stories, but you can still tell when you're reading it that, you know, a quantity of research had to go in. And then when you actually talk to the author, you realize, well, actually a lot of research has to go in, because otherwise it would be nonsense, you know, and everything wouldn't make sense. And anyone who knew anything about the time period would call you out on it. So in the end, there's a lot of kind of background research that has to go in, and it ends up, you know, being a lot of work to write what is essentially a relatively short novel, you know.
Makes sense. I bet only like 10% even made it in.
That's the thing. You can almost guarantee that, you know, because you've got to write the story at the end of the day.
That's really cool.
But yeah, I think it's a clean sweep of, there's one or two books, like Scarlet Pimpernel was slightly disappointing and things like that. But overall, I would say I liked all the books that I read. It sounds like you were happy enough with yours too.
Yes, I was. I was. I was able to read it during breaks at work, just kind of during a tea break and all that, and just chapter at a time, but it kept me interested. It kept me coming back.
Cool. Well, that's us, guys. Tell your friends, please. More people should listen. And then also go to the Patreon and listen to all our other shows. We've got Dark Place Dreamers. Robert and I are working our way through Hammer House of Horror from the 80s. Terrible TV show, and I absolutely love it. You might not know this, Alex, The best scene from the entire show is a bunch of children at a birthday party. The pipes open up. The episode is called The House That Bled to Death. And the pipes just gush blood over these little children and the birthday cakes and everything. It's the best scene in TV history.
You see, my guess would have actually been that. You say the house and all that. But no, my mind goes immediately to The Shining for some reason. So
right, okay. You were going that route anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's perfect. That's perfect.
Horribly cheaply made, but fantastic at the same time. And and then with yourself, we're also doing the Aeschylus play that we mentioned. I also upload every month some music archives as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on Patreon. Plus, you get the show early and t-shirts and all sorts. So go check it out. And if you want to get in touch, booksboys@hotmail.com or at booksboyspodcast on the Instagrammicles. I think that's us.
Yes.
We are done.
Have a great... Wait.
Wrong show. Wrong show, sir.
Shakespeare? No.
I'm gonna take us out with a song. This month, I'm going to go a very different route, and I'm going to do a cover, Blank, by the Smashing Pumpkins.
That's better than my outro. So.
So if the DJ would spin that record, and we'll be back in about a month.
Boy.
Books Boys was presented by The Dean and PJ Burke in association with Thaddeus Penguin Productions. This episode was brought to you by our sponsor, Books Boys on Tour, If you would like to get in touch, you can email us at booksboys@hotmail.com or visit us at booksboys.com. The intro uses Driving in the 70s from the Of Soundtracks and Garage Bands EP by Trapdoor. And the outro uses Dog's Light by Bravo Marx from the album of the same name. All music used is either Podsafe or used with permission. If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/booksboys, get the show early and all of our bonus Booth Fan the Boys shows, and you can also check out our music on Spotify or Apple Music. Thank you kindly for listening to us. Please tell your friends and come back next time for another episode of Books Boys.
Read some books!
There we go, a nice 90 minutes. I forgot to do the sponsor. Do you think they'll... I'll just throw in the turd. Do you think they'll notice? We've never forgotten to do the sponsor before. Goodness gracious me.